Welcome to another episode of Resilient and Real. On today's episode, I speak with Enrique Gonzalez, a DBH alcohol and drug counselor. Enrique shares info for family, friends, and loved ones who are impacted by a person with a substance use disorder, as well as helpful resources for those ready to seek treatment. Enrique also shares his inspiring story of recovery as he celebrates a milestone in his recovery journey. We hope you enjoy this episode. Hi, Enrique. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
So tell our listeners, what do you do for our department?
So I am an AOD counselor, alcohol and other drugs counselor, for the Department of Behavioral Health here in the city of Rialto. That entitles engaging with clients face-to-face from beginning to end, starting with the initial contact, intake, assessments, orientation, individual counseling sessions. We do discharge planning, refer them to a lower level of service, whether it be recovery services or an aftercare program.
So before I started working for behavioral health, I was aware of social workers and clinicians, but I hadn't yet heard of alcohol and drug counselors. How is the work that you do different from that of a social worker or a clinician?
So clinical social workers have a lot of education. There's a lot of education, a lot of training. With the alcohol and drug counselors, our focus or our education is basically substance use disorders. The other aspect of our work, like I mentioned earlier, would be referring clients out to services that we can't provide for them, such as social services or therapy with the clinician or medication with the psych doctor or a medically assisted treatment, something like that, where we aren't able to provide those services, more so the social services type of thing. Most of the time when a client comes to us, it's the alcohol and drug treatment that is needed because of the substance use, a lot of other things, a lot of other negative situations have occurred in their life, like housing, failure to appear in court, so maybe some kind of medical services. So then that's where the more of the social worker kind of steps in. The clinician kind of steps in and assists the client.
So you're saying while under the influence, in your experience, how many times is it because of the influence?
That's a good question. I can't put a number on it, but right. I can tell you it's quite high. What happens is when an individual begins to use substances, I call it a three-tier level. So the top tier would be, hey, we're having fun, right? We're drinking, we're doing drugs, whatever the situation or the substance might be. Second tier is, okay, we're having fun, but now we're not taking care of our responsibilities and they're starting to stack up on us, right? So we're still having fun. We're still kind of liking it. But at the same time, we're starting to avoid family. We're starting to avoid responsibilities. We might be calling in sick to work or missing school. The road becomes a little rocky. And then the third tier I like to call is trouble, nothing but trouble. So now we're engaging in possibly illegal activities to have money to buy our substances. We might be in trouble with the law at this point, where failure to appear in a court date, possession charges, maybe open CFS cases with Child and Family Services due to being irresponsible and not taking care of our children.
I'm thinking, and correct me, please, if my thought process is incorrect, but you know, even for me, someone who's not in recovery, I would think appearing in a court of law or having to deal with a CFS case would just be devastating, you know, and I think everyone to some extent has some sort of coping mechanism. So if someone who's in addiction and that is their coping mechanism, how difficult is it to stop using or to get out of that? You know, it just seems like in order to deal with the CFS case, like I'm going to drink these, my worries away.
Yeah, that's a very good question. And it is a very difficult situation to be in and to pull out of. We have a lot of individuals that we work with being referred to us through CFS, through the Child and Family Services Department, who have an open CFS case. And unfortunately, not all make it out. In other words, not all follow the requirements given to them by the Department of Child and Family Services. And unfortunately, they do lose their children to the system. What happens is when one isn't actively using the substance, whether it be alcohol, meth, opiates, marijuana, there comes a point where I call it the fine line, where we are no longer in control of the substance. The substance is now in control of us. And for somebody who doesn't understand recovery or has never been in recovery, it might sound a little foreign to you, right? Why can't they just stop? And unfortunately, it's not that easy, because now we've gone beyond that fine line. And now the substance is in control of us. And that's where all these negative behaviors, addictive behaviors, criminology or crime occurs, you know, and then also the lack of responsibilities, right? With our children, maybe paying our bills, no light, no electricity. CFS is going to come knocking on the door, and that house is inhabitable for children. It also depends on what kind of support, or I should say, having some sort of support from either family members or taking advantage of community support does help a lot.
Speaking of support from family members, that gets into a whole nother thing where I have heard the term enabling. I come from a family where I have people in recovery, and that was always the argument. You know, one side says, oh, every time you give this person money, you're enabling them to continue in their addiction, while the other side says, cut them off completely. They're only going to stop when they hit rock bottom. You know, don't even open the door, let them in. I remember my friend actually had a brother that was in recovery. And I remember her reaching out to me and she said, you know what? My brother showed up at my friend's house, standing at the door, and said, hey, I need a place to sleep. And I said, What did you do? And she said, I told my friend, don't let him in because he'll never leave. And to me, that was like, oh, that's so sad. But she had gotten to that point where she was just done with it. So how do we know what the right choice is?
So I like that you brought that enabling up, because that is a very fine line as well. Right. You know, when I say support from family and the community, the support I'm talking about is not financial, mm-hmm. right? I'm not going to give an addict $20 and expect them, you know, to do what they're supposed to do with that money. They're probably going to go out and use, right? Mm-hmm. 9 out of 10 times, they're going to go out and use. The support I'm talking about is, okay, let's make sure you get to treatment. Okay. Let's make sure you make your appointments. Let's make sure you get to the courthouse. Let's make sure that somebody's available to give you a ride and to pick you up mm-hmm. to and from your program. The community support. Let's take advantage of social services that offering bus passes if I need a bus pass, or some kind of support with. I know that there's programs that assist individuals, mothers, with clothing for the child, bedding for the child, also rent assistance, mm-hmm. Depending on the situation. It is difficult to turn away a loved one, right? Knocking on the door saying, hey, look, I got kicked out, or hey, I don't have a place to stay, or hey, you know, I'm at rock bottom. Because it is a fine line if you let them in and stay. And it's true, they might not ever leave or not want to leave. There's also support by, okay, let me help you find a place. Let's look for a shelter. Let me get in contact with the county and see what opportunities, what programs are available for you. Maybe we can get you a bed. Are you willing to work with me? I'll work with you if you work with me.
I'm so glad that you brought that up. I don't think I've ever really thought about that. I think just even in life in general, I've found that to be the case. Like really a lot of people, they see an issue, they want to fix it, and they just want to kind of throw money at it. Okay, let me give you some money. Like it, I mean, not even with this, just anything, right? Like, okay, you're down, something's happening, let me send you some money. Because I think it's so much easier just to hand somebody a check or send them a Zelle or something than it is to say, okay, I'm going to take the day off.
Yeah.
I'm going to meet you at your house. We're going to spend all day calling your insurance company, the doctor's office, Medi-Cal, and getting all these things done. I mean, that's really where it gets difficult and where it becomes an investment. And I found just in life in general, it's so hard to get people to do that. That's the thing that I value most out of my relationships is those people who are willing to come alongside me, like through those difficult things.
Yeah. It is difficult, right? Do I want to take a day off? Probably not, right? That's where that fine line comes in. Okay, if I let you in this house, and you are right, like you mentioned earlier, this individual's probably not going to want to leave. But if I let you in this house and we work together, you promise me that we're going to work together in finding you a place. Yeah, it might take all day. It might take a few days, but we're going to get you somewhere.
You know, in my life, sometimes when I do tell people that, hey, I'm not going to give you money, but I'll do this, the next words out of their mouth are, hey, no thanks. I'm not interested. You know, so it's kind of like, all right.
And you know what you do at that point? Give me a call when you're ready.
Right. Exactly.
And I tell parents and family and siblings, you know, you're enabling the individual. It's called tough love. Do we want to see our child out homeless, struggling? No, we don't. But at the same time, if we allow them back in, it's enablement. And we're just prolonging the inevitable.
You hurt my heart.
It's tough. And I talk to my clients, family members, just like that. We have to. I mean, there's a fine line, you know. And you know what also helps for those family members who have individuals, siblings, loved ones, husbands, wives, parents, is Al-Anon. There's a great program called Al-Anon. It is a 12-step.
So I hear Al-Anon and I think it's only for alcoholics.
Well, there's different ones.
Oh, okay.
There is different ones. And you can tailor it to your specific individual, what they're going through, because they assist family members, those who are not in recovery, right? Mm-hmm. Somebody like yourself who might have a family member or another individual who might have a family member struggling with substance use. They help the individual teach them and how to deal with their behaviors, how to deal with their attitudes, how to deal with the individual who is in recovery. Because what happens for a lot of us who are in recovery understand that just because we're sober now doesn't mean that it's going to be rainbows and lollipops. It's not. A lot of times individuals bring their addictive behaviors, addictive characters into recovery. And that's a day-by-day process. And that's where the 12 steps of recovery come in. That's a great way to start working on those defects, working on those behaviors and attitudes. And also they have it for sober individuals who are a family member of the recovering individual to assist them and help them understand what that individual is going through. And believe me, it makes life a lot better for both parties.
Yeah, thank you so much for mentioning that. I think I will actually go and sign up for one of those because I have a lot of hurt in my heart, you know, because substance use disorder, it impacts the family and it just breaks your heart, I think, like nothing else does.
Yeah.
You know, I think the issue for me is like, I'd like to think that I'm able to forgive people, you know, like I know, you know, I love the Lord, like Jesus Christ, my Lord and Savior, and he's forgiven me for everything. So I can't hold anything against someone else. But in the same sense, I'm like, I can't forget it either, right? Because I don't want to put myself in a position where I allow this person to hurt me or my family again. Yeah. You know, I love the person. I want relationship with them, but I don't want to feel that hurt anymore.
And that's where the tough love comes in. And it's hard. I know it's not easy. It really isn't. If an individual is serious about getting help, about staying sober, about becoming part of a program, a recovery program, if they're serious about it, you will see the change in that individual. You will see that individual doing all they have to do to maintain their sobriety. If, hey, listen, if I got to go to 3 meetings a day to maintain my sobriety, I'm going to do it. And for a lot of individuals, that's how it usually starts off at the beginning. We have to do everything we can to become part of the No Matter What Club. Because guess what? Life still happens, right? We still have failures. We still have trauma. We still have, you know, loss of loved ones, loss of a job, a separation, a family issue, something that's going to be a traumatic event in our lives. And what do addicts normally do to avoid feeling those feelings? We get loaded to feel numb.
Right.
And so what the programs do is they teach us how to avoid using to feel numb. We pull the tools that we learned out of our tool belt while in recovery so that we can fend off those urges, those cravings, those temptations. We build a sober support network with individuals who are like-minded. Hey, listen, I'm going through this. Let me give this person a call. They're in recovery, and we can walk through it together. And that's a lifeline. And I encourage all my clients, hey, listen, start introducing yourself to an individual at every 12-step meeting you go to. Get some phone numbers, network, build a sober support system. I know that when individuals build that support system, and I know you mentioned Jesus Christ, Lord and Savior, adding a spiritual component to your program of recovery also is a huge advantage, and you have a much higher probability of being successful.
Enrique, I know that you've shared before, you've been on our Recovery Happens panel, and you've shared a little bit of your story. Maybe you could tell us briefly for those who haven't heard it.
So, yes, I've been in recovery. Actually, here in about 3 days, I'll have 14 years of clean time.
Wow.
My last date of use was March 3rd of 2008.
Wow.
And I had tried recovery or tried to get into recovery prior to that date for several years. I didn't understand NAAA. I'd never been to program. I didn't understand what recovery process, all that, avoiding triggers. I didn't understand negative influences that would only encourage me to use. They were my friends, or I thought they were my friends. And so I continued to hang out with them. I might achieve a week, 2 weeks of sobriety, and then I would relapse. You know, after several run-ins with the law and several prison terms, I was sitting on the curb on March 3rd of 2008, being arrested as the police are going through my car and finding drugs. I finally as I was sitting on the curb, I remember reaching out to my higher power, who I also call my Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. And I said, Lord, now mind you, I'm sitting on the curb, handcuffed. I said, I can't do this anymore. I don't know what I'm going to do, where I'm going to go, how I'm going to get there, but I can't continue on this path. Please change my life. And I did end up going back to prison. I stood sober. I got out. While in prison, I took advantage of every opportunity that I had. Spiritually, the 12-step community while in custody, I would go to meetings they had there from people coming into the facilities from the 12-step community. And when I got out, I started to attend church and meetings locally. I moved out of the environment that I was in. That was a big help, right? Old people, places, and things. I avoided all of that. And I maintained my sobriety. I met my wife. And she was also a huge encouragement to my sobriety. Back in 2013, I decided to return to school. Let me back it up a little bit. When I left prison, I was sent to Cedar House here in Bloomington.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
To do a program for 5 months. I graduated that program, got off of parole. I eventually got married, and in 2013, I went back to school. I continued at Valley College, my education, I got my associates. I then transferred to Cal Baptist, and I got my bachelor's in human services last spring. And this fall, I'll be, God willing, enrolling into Cal State San Bernardino for my master's in social work. So has it been easy? No. There's been times where I definitely had wanted to throw in the towel, right? Had trauma since I've been sober. Family members have passed. But through all of that, through those traumatic events, I always had somebody in sobriety to help me walk through those situations. I had a lovely family, my wife, very supportive. I'll be having 14 years of sobriety, and I wouldn't change it for the world.
That's so awesome. Thank you so much for sharing that. Isn't it? It's like another life, isn't it? That's what I think.
Yeah, you know, and that's funny to say that. I was just explaining to a client, we were having group yesterday morning, and she was telling me how things are so different now that she's sober, you know, right. How she is doing what she calls the normal things, like getting a good night rest, communicating with her parents, going on outings like to the park where she can walk in freedom and not, you know, be subjective to being strung out on opioids and having to use every couple of hours just to get well.
Wow.
And so I was explaining to her, so this is what we consider to be normal, right? And so I asked her, so what do you see? How do you see your life before you got sober? Mm-hmm. You know, she says, oh, I see that completely abnormal. And so I said, so when you were in that life or that active addiction, how did you see, you know, the normal individual to say, you know, having a good night rest, communication with family, taking walks in the park? He said, oh, that was completely abnormal for me. You know, so it's now that she's in a different place, sober, she sees the difference that at that time in her active addiction, now she sees as abnormal. But at the time, it was just her normal lifestyle.
So in the month of March, we as a department and our county and even our nation, we celebrate National Prescription Drug Abuse Awareness Month. Can you tell our listeners why it's important for us to acknowledge that?
It's definitely an important topic. There is a crisis, right? And it's been a crisis for quite a few years. But there's this new problem that has arose more recently within the last couple of years. The opioid crisis has been around for quite a while. The pain medication, we've had a lot of individuals struggle with pain medication abuse in relations to starting off by maybe either a sports injury or a car accident where they were given these prescription medications for the pain and eventually got strung out on them. And unfortunately, the medications got too expensive after the doctor cut them off. So they turned to stuff like street drugs, like heroin or buying pills off the street, on the street. And so what's going on right now is this crisis with fentanyl. This fentanyl crisis is pretty severe right now, and it's definitely something that needs to be addressed. We are seeing an influx of pills disguised as Percocet or oxycodone pill, and it's actually damped to look like one of those pills, but in actuality, it is fentanyl, which can be 50 to 100 times stronger than heroin. And so we're seeing an influx of that coming in from overseas and from down south onto our streets. And a lot of individuals don't know what they're taking. They're thinking it's a Percocet or oxycodone, and unfortunately, it's actually fentanyl. And so we're seeing a lot of individuals coming in and saying they have a history of overdosing because of that medication that they're taking and buying off the streets.
So if you find yourself in that unfortunate situation where, you know, you're finding that you need that painkiller a little more than you probably should, what do you recommend that person does?
So there's several things that can be done. We do offer here in our department, and the County of San Bernardino does offer what is called medically assisted treatment. We do it for opioids as well as alcohol abuse. So there's a couple of different medications that are used. The more famous or the more used one, I would think, is the more commonly used one is Suboxone for the opioid, and then the Vivitrol for the alcohol. With the opioid medication, medically assisted treatment medication program, is an individual in that situation would port to the ARMC Arrowhead Regional Medical Center. And I believe St. Bernardine's also has the ED, what is called the ED Bridge. It's the Emergency Department Bridge Program. And the bridge means we're bridging the hospital with our program. And there's several other community programs that also do the same thing we do, where they connect the individual with the outpatient program with us, should they want to get on a maintenance program. So that's one option, right? And then they'll be put, they'll come to our outpatient program and they'll be put on this medically assisted treatment program. And there's also the option of actually going into a program and going through what is called a withdrawal management program or a detoxification. So they would need to contact the county screening and referral center, assessment referral center, which is SARC. And then they would be screened and then placed on a list for a detox bed.
Enrique Gonzalez, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
As Enrique mentioned, DBH has a confidential, free, 24 hours a day, 365 day a year helpline for youth, adults, and family members facing substance use disorders. The phone number is 1-800-968-2636. It's National Social Work Month. To celebrate, DBH will highlight some of our incredible social workers on our social media pages. Today, Fabiola Lazaro, Social Worker 2 of Triage Engagement and Support Teams, shares why she became a social worker.
I've grown up always having like a passion for helping people. And I found this was my passion. This is what I enjoyed doing. And I like going to work, not feeling like it's work. This is something I enjoy, coming into work and working with the community and connecting with the community, assisting them with services and linking them to services. A lot of the people that I interact with are currently in a crisis. So in that moment, they may be needing support from someone, somebody to listen to them, somebody to advocate for them. So just being present in that moment with them while they're going through their current crisis, I think, is the most important thing to do. That's why I decided to get into social work.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Resilient and Real. As always, if you'd like to share your story on the podcast or have any feedback, we'd love to hear from you. Send us an email at dbh-publicrelations@dbh.sbcounty.gov. Remember to follow us on social media for all things DBH. Until next time, live life resilient and real.